I am going to turn on the Zendo audio amplification, which I'm sure is going to change how things sound on Zoom a little bit. Sorry, Bob. let me know if it's just too much. We do have the speaker aimed toward the back of the room, so hopefully. Okay, that now I've amplified in the Zendo. Bob. Does it sound just terrible?
Sounds like you're talking inside of an empty grain elevator space.
As long as I'm audible, I think we'll have to just deal. Because we have more people in the Zendo today, so eventually they kind of need the amplification too. So we'll slowly figure it out. So I will go around and greet people on Zoom, and then we'll go around the Zendo and each person will say their name and we'll repeat it. So I'll begin with Mark. Etsido. Paulette. Christina. Bob.
Bob.
Karen.
Karen.
Rosemary. Dennis. Ellen. Mary.
Mary.
Peter.
Peter.
Zach.
Zach.
Joseph.
Joseph.
Pat.
Pat.
Lisa.
Lisa.
Vin.
Vin.
Andy.
Andy.
Phil.
John.
John. Brian.
Brian.
Amelia.
Amelia.
Jeannie.
Sabrina.
Sabrina. Michelle and Terry.
Michelle and Terry.
So-on. Ruth Ann.
Ruth Ann.
Katie.
Katie.
Dave.
Dave.
Amy.
Amy.
Andrew.
Andrew. Andrew. Alice. Jim, Leah, Linda,
Judith.
All right, what a group today. Wow. 26 people on Zoom and 11 of us in the Zendo. All right. So in terms of announcements, you still have time to sign up for the spring term student program. There is a opening retreat on Saturday, February 26th, I believe, and the closing retreat is Saturday, May 14th. I might be slightly wrong on those dates, but around there. It's on the Brightways End calendar. And the idea is that you commit to a term of practice. So you come up with your own vows. The minimum requirement is to attend that opening retreat and that closing retreat. Ideally, you also do, you know, participate in some Sangha stuff in the meantime, but you basically form a cohort with the people who sign up for the program. And we're going to do, for anybody who's just thinking about this, we're going to make more of an effort to stay connected as a cohort throughout that time, because we realize it's a little trickier. We, you know, once upon a time, we were all just right here, and we might schmooze over tea or something. But especially because many of the participants are on Zoom, I'm going to encourage people to attend these Saturday Sangha check-ins. So there might be some other people there as well, but that will be a way for term students to get, you know, stay more in touch. And if there ends up being a lot of people at those check-ins, we can always put the term students off into a breakout room. And I'm also toying with the idea of a weekly reflection that we do via our email list. So I form a list, an email list for the term students for the duration. And just a couple sentences or more of reflection a week is something that I think would help keep us in touch. So please consider being part of that. I generally suggest, though, that you have been regularly involved with the Sangha already for at least a few months. Because usually, like, you don't want to, that's something to get used to in and of itself. You don't need to add another commitment or vow on top of just seeing if actually, like, participating with this Sangha is what you want to do. So any questions about that or upcoming stuff or anything else I should announce? Alice?
How do we formally sign up for the term?
Ah, so she asks, how do we formally sign up for term student? And basically, it's just send me an email. info@brightwayzen.org, or, you know, like, if you go to the website, it gives you that contact email. And I'll just add you to the list. And there is a description of it that's been shared in the newsletter, and it's on the website as well, that to tell you more about what's involved. Okay. I guess I will begin. So this is what I'm calling challenges in Zazen number 3. So this all started with a Q&A session in December where somebody asked about what to do about discomfort and pain in Zazen. And I didn't get around to answering that question until like late January, but I gave a talk on physical discomfort, and then the second time I took questions about that. And all of these talks are recorded and they're posted on our website. So if you want to go back and review these, I've also been doing my podcast episodes on these as well. So you can, so the next podcast episode that comes out will be more about the physical posture and discomfort. But then we did the Q&A, that took half the time, and then I got started on these maybe emotional and mental challenges during Zazen. So the idea is that these are kind of unpleasant things that might make you less likely to want to sit. So we just started on those for the last talk, and we talked about drowsiness and dullness. So if that's an issue for you, please go back and check that talk, and I'll also be talking about it on the podcast soon. We also talked about perseverating on upsetting situations or negative thoughts. And the gist of my recommendation for that was, you know, you play it by ear. If this is something that is really disruptive to your life, you know, you may need help, you may need counseling or help. But if it's, and depends on how disruptive it is to your Zazen as well, if it's just kind of annoying and it comes up sometimes, I recommend just sitting with it, letting it pass. But if it's something, like I said, the bad thing about some of these loops of perseveration is that they're self-perpetuating. So if it's a depressive loop, or if it's an anxious loop, or it's a self-critical loop, the further down you go, the more momentum builds, and it tends to be something that doesn't just pass because it's it's building. In which case, that's the one situation where I do recommend perhaps using some of what I call directed effort techniques, as opposed to simply shikantaza. So that's, you know, all kinds of things, following the breath, body scan, breath counting, some kind of, you know, thing that you are turning your mind to instead of that perseveration. So that's the gist of that. So today, I don't know how far I'll get, right? This can't go on forever, but let's see. I was going to talk about troubling emotions. Depersonalization, which is a term that Etsido turned me on to last week. I hadn't been familiar with that term, although I'm familiar with the phenomenon. and I'll explain more about what that is. Makyo, what I'm calling blender mind, which is where your thoughts just whip around so fast and so randomly that it's actually quite unpleasant. Boredom and frustration. So I tried to make this list more or less exhaustive. So I might mention something, for instance, like Makyo or the depersonalization that is only relevant to one or two people listening. But it is worth mentioning because if there are one or two people here who have that experience, it can be very important to, you know, hear about it, to hear, yes, this happens. It's, you know, here, it's okay. This is, it's expected. This is what you might do about it. So keep that in mind. And I also want to say what's really important is to do our own practice and not compare ourselves to others. Now that's easier said than done, right? Because frankly, some of the things that we're talking about sound, you know, awful, but some of them sound kind of intriguing. And we might actually get distracted by them. We might actually think, oh, this means my meditation is going well, or it's deep, or if you hear somebody else is having this experience, it might sound like they're making some kind of progress or have some kind of experience you don't have. I know it's hard, but I just recommend just your experience. Every one of us is so different, and you don't really know what kind of experience you're going to have when you sit down, and there's no accounting. So, you know, for instance, I'm going to talk about troubling emotions come up, and I've had people say, I never have any emotions come up in my zazen. Like, should I? And I just say, no, you know, we don't know what's going to be happening. So to begin, and I hopefully can leave a little bit of space for Q&A, but there is a lot here as well. So hopefully there'll be a balance there. Getting this across, not dragging it out to yet another Dharma talk, although I guess I could. So troubling emotions, and by this I mean raw, unprocessed emotions, including activation of trauma from the past, of things that really come up powerfully. So there's a decision to be made if this happens for you. You know, how are these emotions impacting you? If they're making it difficult for you to live your daily life, this is across the board. If any of these things interfere with your daily function, then, you know, talk to somebody, talk to a teacher, talk to a therapist, you know, get some help, because that shouldn't be happening. Or maybe that's not even the best way to put it. Just it can help to get some other eyes on the problem. And if emotions come up in particular, I do recommend therapy. I don't know if that's something that you, you know, feel comfortable with or not, but the reason that I would recommend that is, to be honest, Zen isn't that good at that. It's good at you know, encouraging you to sit through it and to make space for it and to accept it and that kind of thing. But, you know, the kind of tools that modern psychology have to help you reflect and review things and process things and accept things and talk about things, you know, Zen is going to probably encourage you to get over stuff perhaps sooner than you should. So, you know, if you really feel like, actually, no, I need to feel these things and I need to explore them, then I recommend, you know, modern psychotherapy. Not instead of Zen, but in addition, at least. But if the troubling emotions are not, you know, too much to deal with, or you already have professional support and they think meditation is fine, I think Zazen can be helpful for opening up to our emotional experience and allowing the emotions to move through us. I sometimes like to think of in Zazen, like opening the doors of the mind. You're not going looking for, you know, emotional weird stuff or trauma or whatever. You're not going for that, but you're opening yourself up to it in a way that I think probably subconsciously much of the time we're kind of like this, right? We're like, I don't want to feel that. I don't want to go there. I don't want to think about that. So we're just, if you feel the strength, if you feel the stillness, to just kind of open that up and, all right, we don't know what's going to wander through these doors. So sometimes these, you know, it allows things to come up or allows us to realize things that we feel that otherwise we were kind of suppressing or pushing away. And as we feel them, it's good to try to have faith that this is a process, that this too shall pass. I think most people here will probably relate to the experience of if we open up to the emotional experience, it may be painful or troubling, but it can move through us in a way that it doesn't if we keep it hidden and suppressed. It may be a painful process. It may come up quite a lot depending on, you know, what it is. But, you know, trying to have some faith that it will not always remain as intense or painful. But also, as these things come up, it's also good to try to avoid clinging to them or weaving too much of a narrative about them. And again, like I'm saying, this is okay, now you're going to apply Zen to your experience as opposed to, you know, psychotherapy. You may need to reflect on and, you know, build a narrative and figure stuff out. But once we are sitting with it in this way, it's good to recognize, I mean, all narratives are kind of arbitrary and empty and inadequate to convey the truth of our experience. So we create the narratives to make sense of our lives, but ultimately, you know, they are not us. So, you know, we wanna hopefully just be as intimately and in as real a way with that experience as we can. And you may end up realizing things that you want to contemplate and analyze. Oh, I think that happened in my childhood and da da da. And I would just recommend that, you know, trying to reserve the space of Zazen for that more direct experience and then, you know, reflect on it later if you want to do that. Because, and I've had people ask this question, because, you know, we talk about Zazen as being, you know, in the here and now, in the present, but we're also not like pushing away, we're not pushing anything away as we do that. So when we experience thoughts and feelings sometimes, that is essentially, that's the past appearing in the present. So can be present with our thoughts and our feelings, even the narratives going on in our head, we can be present with that and it's really not about the past. You know, I mean, it's connected to the past, but it's not, we're not thinking about the past. We're thinking about what is right here, right now. So, and same with thoughts and worries about the future. You know, that is the future appearing right now. That is what you're experiencing. So I guess, how about I just pause there at the risk of drawing this talk out into yet another day? Let's see if there's any questions or reflections on just the arising of troubling emotions in Zazen. Phil.
Your talk's reminding me of about 10 years ago, I kind of figured out that, in meditation, I'm not supposed to try and stop all of my thoughts. And as soon as I started practicing with that, well, not as soon, but practicing with that, what I found was that I would go into meditation with this hierarchy of things that were, front and center in the mind, or problems, or so on. And if I didn't chase after those, I would then be able to, I noticed without trying that things would kind of all become about of the same importance. Like things sort of settled into, like they were higher and lower, and then all of a sudden they were just kind of there, but all just the same. So that I worked as a personal trainer at the time, and I would suggest to clients that they try meditation, and they would almost always say, well, I tried it and it didn't work. And I was, how do you know it didn't work? Because my thoughts didn't stop. So I learned from actually hearing people say that so often that that was definitely not the way to go. So,
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeshe Tsoki. And would you change that to the speaker view? Unfortunately, that means you're going to see me big, but oh well. Let's see. Go ahead, Yeshe.
One of the things that I was going to add is that when the strong emotions come up, there's, for me, there's essentially three things. There's broader, but just to cut to the chase, one is resisting it and I don't want it, and then it just gets more intense. The other is what for me was a misunderstanding of being with it, which was actually only deepening and worsening it and following it down a rabbit hole to nowhere that was going to get reconciled. It was almost like fueling it. So being with it, I think is a tricky terminology. And then I realized that being with it is not resisting it, not getting stuck to it, but actually being in the place of spacious mind where the uncomfortable emotion or feeling is still happening, is still a sensation, an experience, a thought, whatever. And at the same time, I'm being with it as any other thought that might arise, but again, in that place of, that's the only thing I can think of. It's a sense of spaciousness where I'm observing it at the same time that it's happening. So to me, that's what being with it is, but it's not an attachment. It's more of an experience without becoming it, and recognizing that it's just still a whole bunch of thought fluff, and that thought fluff that comes up can also, that thought fluff can dissipate, but I don't have to become the thought fluff. I can be the sky around the thought fluff, if that makes any sense.
Yes, thank you. It reminds me of what Kyogen used to say, which was, what we're trying to do is become more identified with the space through which the content moves, as opposed to the content. We're not trying to get rid of the content or judge the content, but we're trying, it's a subtle shift, but it makes a big difference, which is why modern psychology is starting to encourage people to be mindful and do meditation. Leah.
Yeah, I was wondering if In meditation before, I had emotions come up, and they produced some physical thing, like I laugh, something is hilarious, or I'm feeling joy from somewhere, or I'm crying and a tear, and because something is right. So I'm sitting with it and not clinging, being very accepting, letting it move through me and everything. But that is the thing that sometimes, well, now I'm crying and I can't stop, or I'm laughing. You know what I'm saying? Like that physical reverberation of the thing is the thing where it's like, then me trying to stop it becomes this big, you know, like, oh my gosh, now I'm crying. Oh no. And then it starts to spin and spin, like, oh no, I'm laughing. I shouldn't be laughing. And then it's like, spin. So, I mean, it doesn't happen all the time, but when it does, it's always been a question, like, so how am I going to zazen through this one?
That is a very good question. And it's, I mean, because I guess we're trying to be still, right? So there's this kind of, that's the aspiration. And especially if you're sitting with other people, right? There's this pressure. But on the other hand, like you said, you can just like get into some kind of crazy weirdness if you're like, if this really is just kind of a really involuntary kind of thing. And I just know that at Great Vow, there have been, the nearby monastery, there have been a number of residents. And a lot of times, I don't know about a lot of times, but it seems like these kinds of things can sometimes be associated with past trauma and stuff like that. Like there's something in the body that just comes out. And so there's a guy there, total sweetheart, who had just, like, he would start laughing, like, like, and then, you know, the other people would start laughing. But, you know, just looking across the Zendo, looking at the teachers, it was just like they just held it and let it pass, right? So in some ways, you know, it's that fine thing. Like, at what point are we maybe like, oh, yeah, I want to go into this sorrow and I want to cry some more? Or are we going to let it pass when it passes? And if we sob a little bit, if we laugh a little bit, yeah. That's just, you know, everybody else can just learn how to be still with that. I mean, I know the, you know, Great Vow, they sat through like the big Oregon earthquake. What was it, like 10 years ago or something? I can't remember how long ago it was. But they were in session when that happened and they just sat. Ellen.
So it's funny that the laughing thing just reminded me of being in a yin yoga class one time. You're holding something for 30 seconds. People start to lose their minds a little bit for, you know, and they start to laugh and then the whole room goes. So, but I've never heard that happen in zazen. But what I have on my mind is that if, you know, I did a retreat at Zen Mountain Monastery, they send you a whole bunch of information prior. If you suffer from depression or anxiety, that zazen can feel punishing was their word. Zazen can feel punishing. So in response to you saying that, like, Zen, you know, isn't therapy, I really definitely feel that. But I didn't have any problem. I do suffer from anxiety, absolutely. But I found it not punishing, but kind of freeing, because a lot of my anxiety is around the daily concerns. So if I'm removed from the daily concerns, I found zazen actually to be somewhat easier. So that doesn't help with our daily, if you're sitting on your floor in your living room, that doesn't help with that, but it does maybe help to remove yourself if anxiety is a thing that you deal with from the things that cause it, which for me is the clock, what I have to do, and, you know, so.
Yeah. I guess I should, you remind me, I should mention, I think I talked about this a little bit with the perseverating, but that in particular, I mean, if you're really like diagnosably depressed, Zazen may not be in the prescription for a while. Hopefully you're getting psychological support as well, and you can talk to them about it, but just, you know, watch what happens. From what I've heard, you know, if you're really in that cloud of numbness, Zazen doesn't do much for it. You never know, but it often can just deepen it. But you don't have to give up meditation. There are other forms of meditation you can do. So you can do walking meditation. You can do like sutra copying meditation. You could do chanting instead. So, you know, be encouraged. Paulette.
Yeah, it's somewhat a relief to think about not having to get into the content, because many times in meditation, I have stuff come up and it can grip and not let go. And it's nice to know that you can just kind of go with the feeling rather than get into the content. I mean, I've struggled with both anxiety and depression. And I remember one time I was in a retreat and I really wanted to leave. Like, I really wanted to get out of there. And I think Kyogen talks about that in one of these chapters, but I really wanted to get the hell out of there. And I couldn't. And I had a friend who had gone through something similar. So he talked me out of the red. But it was very, very difficult at parts, you know, to be in that situation. So I appreciate what you're talking about.
Anything else about emotions, troubling emotions? I'm sure there's more out there. Alice.
Let's say you had a date with somebody and you're angry. Do you suggest doing Zazen? Because I've heard and I've read that that's an opportune time to sit.
Yeah, so Alice asked if... let's say you just had a tiff with somebody and you're upset, and you know, is that, should you sit? I think it's an awesome time to sit if you could make yourself. But you know that the tendency is going to be to, like, you know, perseverate on it and get upset about it and justify your feelings and all that. But just to watch that is incredible. And I have a description that I've shared at times about I wasn't sitting in meditation, but I was walking reflectively. And I was just furious about something. Just the act of taking the time to think, okay, I'm going to, you know, like Yeshe Tsoki was saying, just to be with this, to just allow it to be mindful of it, is a profound experience of no self, of the emptiness of self, because nothing, I don't know about nothing, maybe lust, but anger is just about as self, you know, the hard self as it exists. So in our description of the precept, we say, do not contrive reality for the self. So when we're angry, our sense of self is up. That is like, you know, so probably protection and lust is just like, that's where our small sense of self is just as lively as can be. So to step back from that in any way and say, I'm going to just reflect as opposed to completely believe this, is the amazing lesson in that, like, huh. Because I just had this sense, like, because I saw this opportunity to let go of my anger. I knew it was going to come back up, but like, at least at this moment, to just let go of my grasping of it. And I thought, but if I can do that, then what's true? You know, who am I? What, So it was kind of disorienting in a way, like, well, maybe all of my thoughts are just random and I don't really mean anything. Because if I can let go of this anger, I guess I can let go of anything. So, yeah. Etzido.
So I just wanted to share something that I'm kind of paraphrasing from Jack Kornfield. And, you know, I think sometimes we can get into kind of this dichotomy that, you know, in the midst of my anger and emotional turmoil, I can either sit or not sit. But, you know, there may be a more middle ground where you can do both. You can kind of sit, and then when it's really uncomfortable, get up, shake out your body, walk around the block, come back, sit some more, where you're kind of slowly creating space for soothing and calming and spaciousness. Whereas you don't have to like force yourself to sit there for 30 minutes. You know, you can sit a little bit, shake it out a little bit, sit a little bit more. I think Jack was going through like a divorce or a separation. He kind of paraphrasing what he did. And I that sounded really useful. I don't know if I'll be able to put that in practice. But I did find that sounded compelling, you know, to be able to sit a little bit, get up and shake it out, because our bodies get so tense during emotional turmoil. Hmm. Just wanted to share that.
Thank you. That's great. All right. Yes,
Tsoki. I you probably want to move on, but I just thought of a quick add-on to that, because a lot of therapy is about learning self-soothing techniques, self-calming techniques, whether it's rocking yourself, walking, whatever it is. And even now working with kids, little like elementary school kids, where there are a lot of behavioral issues and tantrums and, you know, sometimes violent acting out. Now it's like when they're screaming and yelling, I don't want to do this. Part of it is just honoring that, said, I really appreciate your honesty and telling me that you don't want to do this now, rather than, well, you have to do this. But it's honoring that they are being as truthful as they can in the moment. But also sometimes actually putting their own hand over their heart, so they can actually feel for themselves how their heart is pounding, or feel for themselves how there's getting tension in their body. But part of the self-soothing is to get them back in touch with, this is what's happening to you right now. Just be aware, this is what's happening to you. And then after all the, then you can try to move on from there. But
I like that. And it reminds me of how we should avoid editing ourselves. And this is very, we do this very quickly, right? If we're angry, we want to get over the anger. If we're being judgmental, we want to stop being judgmental, you know, whatever it is. And so I guess what I'm recommending is that you don't, just like you're saying, Yeshitsugi, with the kids, just don't argue with the emotion, at least at first, right? Like just, and a lot of times our emotions are completely, like they're not the kind of emotions we want to have, or they're not rational, whatever. And, but they're there. So, you know, my example that I'll use is I'll get just irrationally rageful at stupid little things, like printers not working, you know, doorknobs catching my sleeve, various things like that. And it was like that issue I could not make any progress on it. I tried to, that's stupid, stop doing that, take deep breaths, blah, blah, blah. So I was trying to affect it head on. But essentially, I wasn't taking time to actually experience what emotions were behind that. So, you know, at some point, exactly that, like touching your heart thing, right? I don't know why I thought about doing it. I was pissed about something. And then I just touched my heart and I like felt this, like I felt very stressed and overwhelmed. And I felt like, you know, just everything's coming too fast and I'm not going to be able to finish it and I'm not going to be able to cope. It's all going to be overwhelming. And like, so what was behind that rage was this kind of sense of overwhelm and you know, fragility, which I was like, huh, that's interesting. So, I mean, at least now when I find myself getting angry like that, I'm like, well, somebody's stressed, you know? And I try to have some compassion for myself. I recognize, all right, you know, I probably need to take some time or do fewer things or whatever it is. But it wasn't until I just was with that emotion, or sometimes like, like I was saying, like, you know, anger at red lights or something like that. And just, you know, all right, what am I actually feeling? I'm just like, people should, you know, plan these things better. The people in charge should, you know, they should do a better job. And it'll just be like, okay. But to just accept that and see that lets it move through, right? As opposed to just being stuck. So I think Peter was next.
Hi, Domio.
Hey.
Yeah, what I wanted to say was, you know how you said about emotions that we don't want, right? But here's the thing, like, if I'm totally honest with you, which is awkward to admit publicly, but nevertheless, sometimes when I'm sitting, let's say, for instance, when I'm seething, and I mean like seething with anger, I'll reach a point where I can really just see the anger. And I'm like, okay, that's that. And then there's some part of me that's okay as well. But to be truthful with you, sometimes, and I've thought why I do this, sometimes I just choose to carry on being angry. You know what I mean? And like, I feel like it's like, for me, sometimes I don't have a particularly interesting life for a start off. And I think sometimes like my internal emotions are like the most interesting thing. And like when you're seething, it's like a bit of razzmatazz. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's true.
Yeah. And I mean, come to mention it, you know, I was talking about unpleasant emotions, but you know, we can get attached to pleasant emotions as well and just be sitting there and, you know, whether it's excitement, and there's part of us, I think, that really enjoys being angry, you know, self-righteous and all that. But yeah, I guess it's just a matter of, you know, if we sit there long enough, we just become mindful of what we're doing. And isn't that interesting? You know, and we begin to recognize how we grasp and feed those emotions, and usually that, you know, I guess, and I love the fact that the way that I like to approach Zen anyway is that the primary tool is awareness, and the sense that if we become aware, things will work themselves out, because as sentient beings, we naturally want to be happy and avoid suffering. So if we really keep our awareness open, we hopefully will see, okay, you know, I sat and I stewed and I fed on that anger, and then what happened? If we stay mindful through the whole process, then we can see, oh, okay, you know, I made myself sick, or the next time I interacted with the person I was upset with, I just, you know, spoke inappropriately, or usually the results aren't great. As opposed to perhaps, oh, you know, I'm going to let this anger go a little bit, and then you notice what happens. And I feel like that, just staying mindful is what eventually allows things to shift. Brian. Oh, you're not. We can't hear you, Brian. Did you join audio? No, not yet. Oh. Yeah, it looks like you've joined audio if you can mute and unmute. I don't know, you might have to go into audio settings and turn your microphone level up, perhaps. All right. Well, we're already at 12, so I think it's totally fine to just kind of keep talking about this. save the other things for future talks, because I mean this is a rich topic, and it doesn't have to be limited to emotions coming up just in meditation, right? In the course of our practice, stuff can come up as well. Yeshe.
Sorry to be talking again, but I thought of a couple of things from Kyogen's book related to this, and one is on page 99. He's talking about within all light is darkness, and in darkness there is light. Paradoxically, the voice of the self that promotes equanimity when the self is raging around like an angry bull has become the problem. The self needs to become patient and accepting without trying to superimpose another state of mind on the current state of mind. A parent whose child is having a tantrum cannot force a quality of mind on the child. The parent has to become an all-accepting space in which the event occurs, which both sets limits and doesn't try to control it. Turn the stream of compassion inward, accept the quality of mind, and so what? It's amazing how transforming that is. So that's one part that I just love it. And then when he's talking about the three pure precepts, and he talks about Manjushri, and Manjushri's on this tamed tiger, but the tiger still needs to be there in all its bestiality. We understand a situation from the way we sense it, so it has to be integrated into everything that we are. Spiritual practice is really bloodless and weak when separated from the body and the animal side too much. That's on page 131, when he's talking about Manjushri on the, not the tiger, the lion and the wild beast. Anyway, it goes on and on, but I just felt like those two passages really relate to what we're talking about.
Thanks for sharing, you're right. Right on. Rosemary.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
I have a question about the kind of executive eye thing. So if I'm able to sit and observe some of these things, which gives the impression that I'm not consumed by them, but have a little bit more space, I start to feel guilt times. Yeah, guilty, or feel I'm doing it wrong, because I feel that kind of that strengthens this feeling of this executive eye, as if I'm like above somehow and looking down on myself, and I see the various emotions or thoughts blowing in and out, and as if I'm creating a false sense of I, which in sometimes I think that's what we're trying to get rid of. And I just wondered if that's something, you know, that you battle with, or anybody else does sometimes. I don't know if I've made myself clear.
Yeah. That's a really good point. And I think it's a point of subtlety that probably all of us end up needing to navigate for ourselves as we're trying to, you know, sit. And we're like, okay, you know, I'm observing this emotion, but now it feels a little too detached or dissociated. But if I, you know, if I'm with it, you know, like Yeshe Tsoki was talking about this, I'm with it, but But now I'm just going down too far into it. I'm going down that road. I don't think that's what with it means. It's so we have to navigate this subjective terrain and learn how to do this. But the gist of it is, I think, that you're right, that somehow this can be slightly misapplied, and then we are dissociating from our emotions, and there's a subtle kind of judgment of them, like emotions are lesser. Emotions are just animal. Emotions aren't in control, or emotions are. So I think if there's any kind of tinge of that, of the judgment or agenda, that's that executive eye sneaking in, where I guess when I feel like I am, the awareness doesn't have that sense of separation. I mean, obviously, it's like, or maybe it's like the, I don't know if this helps, but instead, to use a metaphor, instead of it being like, here's the executive eye looking down at the emotions, it's like we've increased our sphere of awareness. So there's still no I mean, we still have a subtle sense of I, but there's still no I. It's just, I'm not only focusing on the emotions or the thoughts. I'm including the emotions and thoughts, but I'm also including my body and the air and just the fact that I'm meditating. And that is what gives that space. So we're not so identified with or wrapped up by or pushed around by the thoughts and emotions. But I think you point out something really good with that. It's tricky. So on.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon now. Yeah, I remember having a conversation with Kyogen about kind of feeling more after starting a Zen practice, beginning to feel more of a sense of self than I ever had, and more of a sense of a unified self rather than this crazy scattered, just kind of a going through my life oblivious. And I remember him saying that, it's like the house builder when, the Buddha said, house builder, you will build this house no more. Well, we're still building houses, and we're going to build a self around anything. And we can even build a self around, I am a Zen practitioner. And that could be the self that you build around. And so, but he also said there's like this healthy sense of self. It's like a self-actualization in a way, that, if you need to deconstruct that later, that's fine. But, for me, going from being just this really scattered and just kind of running on instinct and not really paying attention to my life at all, to becoming like, oh, I feel like a me now. But it felt good and healthy. And it's, I don't practice as often as I used to, but it's still there. And that executive eye is a good way to put that. It's this something that's at the center. And I don't know, that's not necessarily a negative thing.
Well, that was a perfect segue onto the topic that I will address next time, which is depersonalization and how that relates to, the supposed emptiness of self. And so depersonalization is this experience of a kind of dissociation from your own experience, physical, emotional, mental, whatever. That it's, like it can be very extreme or subtle. And you may feel like you're watching your life as if you're in a movie, or have kind of an out of body experience, or an inability to really relate to your emotions or thoughts. Were you pointing at something, Jim? Okay. I thought you said, like, I'm out of time. No, I'm not quite. Very, and sometimes physical sensations and whatever. And these can be, you know, lack of a sense of reality about your own life. And you might think that, well, isn't this what we're going for? We're supposed to realize that the self is empty, consciousness is empty, emotions are empty, da-da-da-da. But, and I'm going to talk about that next week, but like this experience, you might have an experience of depersonalization while sitting or at some other time, and it's not like it's an emergency. It can be as extreme to be a disorder, but that's not what we're going for. So the gist is we're not looking to dismantle or destroy the self. We're looking to transcend the self. So I was so encouraged when I heard when the Dalai Lama came to Portland many, many years ago, and I went to go hear his speech, and he said, you have to have a strong sense of self in order to do this practice. And I thought, well, thank God. Because, I mean, I feel like I was blessed with very fortunate childhood. I feel like I just have a very strong and robust sense of self. I sometimes, you know, I wish it wasn't so strong and fiery. But on the other hand, this isn't about getting rid of that, or that, like Yeshe Tsoki was talking about, that image we have of Manjushri, who's the Bodhisattva of wisdom, who sits calmly on top of this beast. This, you know, eyes rolling to fangs, it's an energetic looking beast. But the Manjushri has come into a relationship with that beast. Manjushri's not standing there with a sword through the beast's head, you know. He's not even sitting there with like reins on the beast. The beast is free, but you know, they've come into a relationship, so the beast isn't just, you know, running amok and creating suffering. But somehow that kind of energy and liveliness can still be present. So,
if I might add,
yes,
I remember asking about, or I remember Gil Coco talking about the children in Dharma school and how they're given some very basic, very palatable teachings about compassion and, you know, mindfulness and things like that. But they don't do like heavy zazen and sitting and stuff like that, because they have not individuated yet. They need to form that their self in a psychologically healthy way, hopefully, before they can take on like, these are the skandhas and they're not, you know, they're an illusion, that kind of stuff. It's too heavy.
And I've been to some, it was a wonderful workshop that I went to a few years ago at Dharmarine, by a woman. She's written a book and is a Zen priest and a chaplain. And she makes a really wonderful case for how it's not just Zen's job to get you to drop the self or transcend the self or forget the self. That if you come for one reason or another, history, childhood, trauma, mental illness, just your karma, just the way you are, if that self is still needs healing and attention and affirmation and growth and support and a sense of trust, that can be part of Zen too. It's not like that's like, oh, that's not what we do in Zen. You gotta wait until yourself is completely healed and, you know, you're ready to just, you know, crush it and forget it. That's not a very, and for one thing, we don't know really about ourselves. We might be surprised. We might think, oh yeah, I've got a real, I'm a healthy, robust sense of, I don't know, maybe in a few years I'll find out that I have some kind of limitation, shortcoming, trauma, something that I need to heal from. And I don't want to have to like leave my spiritual practice in order to do it. So that will be much more about that next week. I'll say our closing verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks, everyone. Have a good week.
Thank you.